This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Marjorie Cohn gives us an update on the recent appearance before the International Court of Justice between South Africa and Israel.
South Africa made a very powerful and compelling case that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza.
We're also joined by three special guests honoring the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
Dr. King called the United States the largest purveyor of violence in the world. Israel is giving the U.S. a run for its money in Gaza.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
On January 11th and 12th, South Africa and Israel appeared in a historic case before the International Court of Justice, ICJ, also known as the World Court, in The Hague. South Africa's legal team made a strong and persuasive argument that Israel is engaging in genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza. South Africa asked the court to impose 9 emergency provisional measures aimed at putting an end to the slaughter. South Africa's application to the ICJ places Israel's genocidal acts and omissions in the broader context of Israel's 75-year apartheid policy, 56-year occupation, and 16-year blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip. This siege was described by the director of the UNRWA affairs in Gaza as, quote, a silent killer of people. South Africa told the court that it, quote, unequivocally condemned the targeting of civilians by Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups and the taking of hostages on October 7th. But, it continued, no armed attack on a state's territory, no matter how serious, even an attack involving atrocity crimes, can provide any justification for or defense to genocide. Israel has, quote, crossed this line. Israel responded by placing responsibility on Hamas for the situation in Gaza. It accused South Africa of a, quote, attempt to weaponize the term genocide. Israel argued that intentional humanitarian law is the relevant framework, that Hamas committed war crimes. In Israel's view, this is not a genocide case. If anyone was the victim of genocide, Israel claims it was on October 7, when Palestinian resistance forces killed what Israel claims were 1,200 people. However, Hamas is not part of this case because it is not a state party to the Genocide Convention. With us today to analyze the genocide hearing in the ICJ is our own co-host Marjorie Cohn. She is Dean of the People's Academy of International Law and a member of the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. Marjorie is also Professor of Law Emerita at Thomas and Jefferson School of Law and former President of the National Lawyers Guild. She writes prolifically about Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory and Israel's violations of the human rights of the Palestinian people. Marjorie, welcome back to the interview chair on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Heidi.
Marjorie, the Genocide Convention says that 2 elements are necessary for a finding of genocide. 1, at least 1 genocidal act, and 2, genocidal intent. What genocidal acts by Israel were cited by South Africa at the hearing in the ICJ?
South Africa argued that Israel has engaged in a systematic pattern of conduct from which genocide can be inferred. Israel subjecting Gazans to one of the heaviest conventional bombing campaigns in the history of modern warfare, from air, land, and sea. The level of Israel's killing is so extensive that nowhere is safe in Gaza. Israel has killed an unparalleled and unprecedented number of civilians with the full knowledge of how many civilian lives each bomb will take. The devastation is intended to and has laid waste to Gaza beyond any acceptable legal, let alone humane justification. Wherever they go, Palestinians in Gaza are subjected to relentless bombing. They're killed in their homes, where they seek shelter, hospitals, schools, mosques, churches. When they try to find food and water, they've been killed if they fail to evacuate, in the places to which they've fled, and even when they're attempting to flee along Israel's so-called declared safe routes. Israel has forcibly displaced about 85% of the Palestinians in Gaza. Now, more than 24,000 Palestinians have been killed in the last 3 months, the overwhelming majority of them civilians. Over 10,000 children have been killed, and nearly 60,000 Palestinians have been wounded and maimed, the majority women and children. Hundreds of multi-generational families have been obliterated. The deliberate killing is the destruction of Palestinian life, South Africa said. No one is spared, not even newborn babies. The scale of Palestinian child killings in Gaza is such that UN chiefs have described it as a graveyard for children. Israel deliberately cut off food, water, and fuel to Gaza, clearly calculated to bring about the destruction of the population. Israel has destroyed or damaged 355,000 homes, and at least 500,000 Palestinians have no home to return to. An unprecedented 93% of the population in Gaza is facing crisis levels of hunger. And this is an astounding statistic, Heidi. Of all the people in the world currently suffering catastrophic hunger, more than 80% are in Gaza. Israel's destruction of Gaza's healthcare system renders life unsustainable. And finally, Israel is imposing measures intended to prevent births among Palestinians, blocking the delivery of life-saving aid, including essential medical kits for delivering babies in circumstances where an estimated 180 women are giving birth in Gaza every day.
Now, Marjorie, how did Israel respond to South Africa's allegations of genocidal acts?
Well, Israel didn't directly contest South Africa's casualty figures. It claimed that while Hamas's strategy is to maximize civilian harm to both Israel's and Palestinians, Israel seeks to minimize civilian harm. Israel told the court that Hamas has a practice of stealing and hoarding aid. But there are extensive Israeli efforts to mitigate civilian harm, Israel argued, and humanitarian initiatives are being undertaken to enable the flow of supplies and provide medical attention to the wounded. Israel says that it is in a war of defense against Hamas, not against the Palestinian people. And Israel said that they have the right to defend themselves, citing the right to self-defense in the UN Charter. Now, military force can be used in self-defense under Article 51 of the Charter if an armed attack occurs against a state, but it must be directed from outside the territory under the control of the defending state. A state can't claim the right of self-defense to defend against an attack that originates inside a territory it occupies. And because Israel has continued to occupy Gaza, it can't assert self-defense in response to the attacks by the Palestinian resistance. Israel, for some reason, didn't mention the ICJ's 2004 advisory opinion on the legal consequences of the construction of a wall in the occupied Palestinian territory. And in that case, the court declared the non-applicability of self-defense under Article 51 in the situation between the occupier Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory.
What evidence of Israel's genocidal intent, the second element, did South Africa cite before the ICJ?
Well, South Africa said genocides are never declared in advance, but this court has the benefit of the past 13 weeks of evidence that shows incontrovertibly a pattern of conduct and related intention that justifies a plausible claim of genocidal acts. They said that genocidal intent is evident from the way that Israel's military attack is being conducted. It's the systematic mass displacement of the population, which is herded into areas where they continue to be killed. It's the deliberate creation of conditions that lead to a slow death. There's a clear pattern of conduct, the targeting of family homes and civilian infrastructure, laying waste to vast areas of Gaza and the bombing, shelling, and sniping of men, women, and children where they stand, the destruction of the health infrastructure, and lack of access to humanitarian assistance. Moreover, South Africa argued, there is an extraordinary feature in this case, and that is that Israel's political leaders, military commanders, and people holding official positions have systematically and in explicit terms declared their genocidal intent. And then these statements are repeated by the soldiers on the ground as they engage in the destruction of Palestinians and the physical infrastructure in Gaza. Israel's genocidal intent is grounded in the belief that the enemy is not just Hamas, but is embedded in the fabric of Palestinian life in Gaza. And a stunning example of one of these genocidal statements was uttered by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as he admonished the soldiers as they prepared their ground invasion of Gaza. He told them, "You must remember what Amalek has done to you," says our Holy Bible, and we do remember. Now, Netanyahu was referring to the first book of Samuel, where God commands King Saul to kill every person in Amalek, which attacked the Israelites as they fled Egypt. And God declared, "Now go attack the Amalekites and totally destroy all that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys." Netanyahu's invocation of Amalek is being used by soldiers to justify the killing of civilians, including children. And the South African legal team showed the court a video repeating Netanyahu's words as soldiers danced, chanted, and sang, "May their village burn, may Gaza be erased."
Utterly chilling just to listen to that. Marjorie, how did Israel attempt to refute South Africa's argument about genocidal intent?
Well, Israel dismissed the remarks that cited by South Africa, the remarks of several Israeli officials, as evidence of genocidal intent. This is what South Africa was arguing showed evidence of genocidal intent. And Israel dismissed the remarks as little beyond random assertions that don't represent official Israeli policy. Israel cited a directive that binds all IDF forces, which states that the laws of armed conflict allow destruction to civilian property only when there's a military necessity to do so, and prohibit harm to property for deterrence purposes only or for the purpose of punishment. It says that it is necessary to treat enemy civilians with respect. This is the policy. Israel also contended that their efforts to both mitigate harm when conducting operations, as well as efforts to alleviate suffering through humanitarian activities, have gone relatively unnoticed and dispel, or at least, at the very least, mitigate against any allegation of genocidal intent. Now, I don't know what media Israel has been reading, but the reality is far from what they're alleging here. And then turning Israel's systematic campaign of ethnic cleansing on its head, Israel characterized its evacuation orders and the displacement of 85% of Palestinians in Gaza as humane acts to get them out of bombs' way. They claim that the Israel Defense Forces dropped millions of leaflets and made more than 70,000 phone calls to warn people to leave their homes to escape the bombing. This past week, one of the Israeli lawyers argued, Israel began a transition to fewer ground troops and airstrikes. He said the war shifted a stage to a new and less intense phase of fighting, and Israel will continue reducing the number of troops in Gaza. Five brigades consisting of thousands of soldiers have already been withdrawn from the territory, he said. Now, although Israel likely announced a change in strategy in anticipation of the ICJ hearing, Benjamin Netanyahu made Israel's real intention crystal clear after the hearing. He said, "No one will stop us, not The Hague, not the Axis of Evil, not anyone else." And of course, The Hague refers to the seat of the ICJ in the Netherlands, and the Axis of Evil, Benjamin Netanyahu is referring to Iran.
Marjorie, I understand that Israel is arguing that the ICJ has no jurisdiction to hear this case. It claims there is no dispute between it and South Africa about whether Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. Can you unpack this for our listeners?
Yes. Well, Craig Murray, a former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, who attended these hearings in The Hague, reported that the judges seemed very interested in the arguments about whether there was a dispute in order for the World Court to assume jurisdiction over the case. Basically, it's necessary that one side state a position and the other side reject it in order for there to be a dispute, and thereby the court would have jurisdiction. But there was probably a sufficient statement by South Africa that it thought Israel was committing genocide, and a sufficient statement by Israel that it was not committing genocide for there to be a so-called dispute between the two. To accuse a state of committing acts of genocide and to condemn it in such strong language is a major act on the part of a state, South Africa told the court. At this stage, it became clear there was a serious dispute between South Africa and Israel, which would end only with the end of Israel's genocidal acts. The South African government repeatedly cited its concerns in the Security Council and referred Israel to the International Criminal Court on October 17th for investigation of genocide. And the South African president publicly declared his abhorrence for what is taking place in Gaza, he said, which is now turned into a concentration camp where genocide is taking place. Israel flatly denied that accusation. South Africa cited Israel's official and unequivocal denial on December 6th that it was committing genocide in Gaza. Now, Israel claims there was not a dispute between it and South Africa about whether Israel is committing genocide before South Africa filed its application with the ICJ on December 29th. Israel argued there needs to be some element of engagement between the parties. The element of interchange and bilateral interaction is required. A dispute is a reciprocal phenomenon. This point has been consistently noted by the court. One party's claim must be positively opposed by the other. Israel argues that South Africa had communicated its position to Israel, but since Israel had not provided a substantial reply, there was no dispute between the countries when South Africa filed its application.
So let's turn to the provisional measures. What is required for the ICJ to order provisional measures? And can you describe the 9 provisional measures that South Africa is seeking here?
Yes, South Africa doesn't have to conclusively prove that Israel's committing genocide in order to get provisional measures. All that's required is a plausible showing that Israel is committing at least some of the charged genocidal acts with genocidal intent. And there needs to be an urgent need for provisional measures to prevent imminent, irreparable prejudice to the rights. In this case, the Palestinians' right to exist and the Palestinians' right to self-determination. So the 9 provisional measures that South Africa is asking the ICJ to order are, first, Israel shall immediately suspend its military operations in Gaza. Second, shall ensure that any military, irregular armed units, organizations, or persons, such as settlers, that are controlled or influenced by Israel, take no steps to further military operations. Third, both South Africa and Israel must take reasonable measures to prevent genocide. Then Israel shall desist from committing genocidal acts. And these are the 4 different types of genocidal acts in the Genocide Convention. First, killing members of the group. Second, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. Third, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. And 4, imposing measures intended to prevent births. Then Israel would be ordered to desist from and take measures including rescinding orders about expulsion and forced displacement of Palestinians, the deprivation of food, water, humanitarian assistance, fuel, shelter, clothes, sanitation, hygiene, medical supplies, and assistance. And also they need to prevent the destruction of Palestinian life in Gaza. Then Israel must ensure that its military and any irregular armed units or individuals do not commit any acts of genocide. And if they do, they must be punished. Then Israel has to take effective measures to prevent the destruction of evidence. It has to submit a report to the court on how it's complying with these provisional measures. It has to refrain from any action that might aggravate or extend the dispute before the court. Of course, Israel opposes the requested indication of provisional measures. They said that this would tarnish Israel's reputation, as if it isn't tarnished already. Basically, there's no evidence that Israel's concealing evidence. This implies that there is. People don't have to be punished for committing genocide in order to temporarily protect rights. And Israel opposed all of the provisional measures that South Africa requested.
Now, Marjorie, do you know when the ICJ is likely to rule on South Africa's request for provisional measures?
Yes. At the end of the hearing, the president of the court said that it would issue a ruling on provisional measures as soon as possible.
And if the ICJ does order provisional measures, how will they be enforced?
Well, the court could order some or all of the requested measures. The actual trial on the merits of whether Israel actually is committing genocide could take several years. But if the court orders provisional measures, then they would go to the Security Council for enforcement. Even if the U.S. vetoes enforcement measures in the Council, a plausible finding of genocide by the World Court could prompt other countries to impose sanctions on Israel. The General Assembly could also convene under Uniting for Peace, a procedure to circumvent a deadlock in the Security Council, and recommend a trade embargo, deployment of a UN military force, or suspension of Israel from its ranks.
What will happen if the ICJ finds that it has no jurisdiction to hear the case?
Well, if the court finds there was no dispute and therefore no jurisdiction, it could deny South Africa's request for provisional measures. But the notion that Israel and South Africa didn't have opposing positions on whether Israel was violating the Genocide Convention strains credulity. It's a possibility, but a remote one, that the court will use this jurisdictional issue to decline to order provisional measures. Should the court dismiss South Africa's case on this technicality, it would encourage genocidal governments in the future to refuse to respond to allegations of genocide and then say, oh, there's no dispute, and they could avoid ICJ jurisdiction.
Now, the big question is, what will happen if provisional measures are ordered, but Israel refuses to comply with them?
Well, if the ICJ finds that South Africa has made a plausible case of genocide by Israel, that may embolden individual countries to prosecute Israeli leaders for genocide under the well-established doctrine of universal jurisdiction. Genocide is so heinous, it's considered to be a crime against all nations, so any country can punish it. It would also fuel the global solidarity movement in favor of the Palestinians and breathe new life into the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which has been so effective that it's very threatening to Israel economically.
Right, right. That makes sense. Now, how would a finding by the ICJ that there is a plausible case that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza affect the investigation that's currently pending in the International Criminal Court?
Well, if the ICJ finds that genocide took place, and this would be at the merit stage, but it could also happen at this stage, a plausible finding of genocide, a finding of genocide would bind the International Criminal Court. They would only need to decide which individuals to prosecute. And I think, as we've talked about in prior shows, there is an investigation of Israel for war crimes and crimes against humanity and some Palestinians as well. Pending in the International Criminal Court for, I believe, 3 years now. They've been sitting on it because of pressure from the U.S., even though they rushed and within a year filed charges against Vladimir Putin for war crimes in Ukraine. So this would give the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Karim Khan, so-called political cover to charge people, charge Israeli leaders, and charge U.S. leaders for aiding and abetting the genocide, if he is so inclined.
Right. We're coming to the end of our segment, Marjorie. What action can our listeners take to support South Africa's case in the ICJ?
Well, Code Pink is organizing delegations to visit UN missions, embassies, and consulates to urge countries to issue public statements in support of South Africa and then follow up with declarations of intervention in support of South Africa once the ICJ issues a preliminary ruling. And also, Code Pink is involved in letter-writing campaigns. You can go to codepink.org/ICJ resources. Scroll down to the volunteer link. There are articles about the ICJ in this case specifically, and you can write to UN missions using the draft letter on the website as a template.
And Marjorie, remind our listeners how they can follow your work outside of Law and Disorder.
Well, I write a regular column on truthapp.org, which is called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. If you scroll all the way down to the bottom of a Truthapp page, you'll see it. Also, my articles and other work are collected on my website, marjoriecohn.com.
Marjorie, thank you for keeping us so up to date on this case. And next time we speak, hopefully there will be some positive developments.
Hopefully. Thanks a lot, Heidi. Appreciate it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
We bring you part of a special program honoring the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. As listeners know, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate was shot on April 4, 1968. Not so well known is the radical Dr. King, who said in the last months of his life that, quote, "Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. With this powerful commitment, we shall boldly challenge the status quo." Joining us are special guests Ruby Sales, a colleague of Dr. King's and co-founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and Reverend Dr. Emma Jordan Simpson, Executive Director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. We're also joined by author and activist Matt Meyer, a board member of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute in New York City. Dr. King began close ties with A.J. Mustey and with the Fellowship of Reconciliation during the Montgomery bus boycott, when FOR staff members Bayard Rustin and Glenn Smiley came to Alabama to support local efforts nonviolently challenging racial segregation. Dr. King developed a special relationship with former FOR chairman A.J. Mustey, whose absolute pacifism King had, as a theological seminary student, questioned. Before heading the Fellowship of Reconciliation, Mustey was a prominent labor leader, helping to found the Militant Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO. And Dr. King, of course, was killed, assassinated, exactly 1 year after taking a staunch anti-Vietnam War position and in the midst of supporting a significant strike of sanitation workers, linking, as he had been, issues of race, class, and violence, as Dr. King deepened his critique of the roots of oppressive United States society. Let's take a listen. Matt Meyer, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to the Law and Disorder studio, especially because we've just honored the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and we're poised to celebrate Black History Month.
Well, it's great to be here again, and it's especially great to have three extraordinary guests. We're joined here by Ruby Sales, a truly iconic figure from the Southern Black-led Freedom Movement. We're also here with Reverend Dr. Emma Jordan Simpson, the new Executive Director of Fellowship of Reconciliation.
Hi.
So we're going to start off with Ruby. And Sister Ruby, it's so great to have you here. And I guess
Thank
we want to just...
It's my pleasure to be here.
Hi, Ruby.
Hi, Heidi.
We just want to start off with your general reflections. We know you've been writing and speaking a lot about not just Dr. King himself, who of course you knew and worked with, but King's legacies and his radical roots in the Southern movements and, of course, the Southern black-led freedom movements that have come to be known as civil rights.
I think it's important to understand, first and foremost, that the movement of which King was a part could only have happened in the Southern soul because of the particular theology that grew up during enslavement. It was a redemptive theology predicated on agape, and it understood that in order to deal with civil rights or any rights, you had to first of all have a transcendental expression. And so black folk who migrated to the North lost that spiritual root. And when you look at movements in the North, which black people were a part of and participated in, two things you notice: that they either had progressive roots, which was a highly materialist movement, or they had roots that were not rooted in any spiritual impulse. Their movements were highly materialistic. Segregation required black folk to continue to develop a theology that reinforced their somebody-ness in a world that said that they were second-class citizens and second-class human beings. It was that continuation of that impulse to matter and to be somebody that created the Southern Freedom Movement and gave birth to freedom fighters like Martin Luther King.
King was a radical. I mean, we've heard you talk about Beyond Vietnam and the work in the last years of his life, but you've also asserted that King was a radical long before 1967, based on those roots. We'd love to hear you say
more about
that.
Well, first of all, it was a radical departure for a black man to stand up and speak in the South, where to speak was a death sentence, was a capital offense punishable by death. It was a radical departure from Southern apartheid for a group of black people to stand up and step outside of our place and assert our right to have a voice and to assert our right to be citizens in a society that said that we were non-citizens. So King's whole beginning, the minute he stepped outside and asserted himself as a full human being and the rights of citizenship along with other black people, that was a radical departure from business as usual during Southern apartheid.
Ruby, can you talk a bit about your own experiences and your interactions with Dr. King?
Well, I was part of SNCC. And SNCC and Dr. Martin Luther King, we had lots of encounters. And we would gather at the Hotel Benmore, which was a gathering spot for young activists and older black ones and white ones. And King would always come in, and he was always dressed to the nines. And he would always come into the Hotel Benmore restaurant and offer to set us up and to offer to buy us a drink. And we were always disappointed that the drink was not a beer but a Coca-Cola. But we had some intergenerational friction over the question, because we were foot soldiers. We were in the line of fire every day, and we thought that we did the hard work, and King got the credit. But having an intergenerational conflict was not the same thing as utter disrespect and contempt. And so we had an ambivalent feeling. On the one hand, we resented him. On the other hand, we deeply loved him. So he decided that he would come to Lowndes County one time, and Stokely and the rest of us got together and said that when King comes, we're not going to fall down and worship him the way these peasants do. We're not going to even say anything. I don't care how well he preaches. We're not going to even say amen. We're just going to stare at him and let him know that we will not be persuaded the way the rest of these people will be. But when he started preaching, I looked over to my right, and Stokely Carmichael, before he could stop himself, was on his feet. And then I looked to my left and Bob Mance was on his feet. And then I couldn't contain myself and I was on my feet. And we just had to look at each other sheepishly and say, boy, that man can sure preach. But the point of the story is that despite our intergenerational friction, we were bound together by a common reality and a common black folk theology. And so that despite all of what we disagreed with, that bond was greater than our disagreements.
Miss Ruby, you talk about moments of transcendence and even experience of transcendence for black people in the South. And I'm wondering, especially after hearing this story that you just shared with us, were there other moments of transcendence for you as a black woman fighting alongside, working alongside these men?
Well, see, you're creating a bifurcation that's modern, that did not exist when we were part of the Southern Freedom Movement, because we were so pressed up against the wall. The urgency was so great that we could not focus on how we were different, that our survival depended upon coming, standing in a common vision and a common mission. And we did not see ourselves within those constructs at that moment, because we were in a war and we had to depend on each other to survive. We lived in a freedom house that was constantly under the threat of being bombed. We were living in a freedom house where white men were night riders who came by the freedom house practically every other night to threaten us. We lived in a war zone where when we were right on Highway 80, suddenly out of nowhere, white men would come in a pickup truck with guns hanging out, shotguns hanging out the window, and and Stokely would always drive, and so you could not get caught up in that kind of bifurcation in a situation where you were on the front line in a war. And so how we understood, I was 17 years old, and I was given a neighborhood in Lowndes County of 2,000 residents. I was young, I was black, and I was female, but nobody doubted my ability to do that work. And so that when you're in a war, those issues of divisions become less important, because you've got to trust each other. Your life is in the other person's hand. You don't have the luxury of debating the theological or philosophical differences that you have. What you've got to try to figure out is, how do you stand together against all of these assaults as a unit? And so that was not a question that I entertained, or even none of us entertained in the movement. White women began to entertain that question much readily than black women did, because black women did not see the necessity of entering into that conversation in such an urgent crisis when our community was being, when every weapon of war was being arrayed against our community.
Like, what do we need to learn from that for today?
I think that what we have come to understand is that the particularities are as important as the universality, that you have to really speak in tongues. And so that in order to stand together, we must begin to speak from the wholeness of all of our identities, without allowing a dialectic where one identity pits us against another person's identity. And so that we have got to stop othering each other, even when we disagree. And there's a way in which I think you have a debate within a community that does not split the community to pieces. And I think what we learn from white supremacy is that when we disagree with people, we have to banish them and they become other. So how do we have a conversation of just where we disagree with each other, but what we always hold fast to the belief that we can provide, Pat, that no one is entrapped by their history, that everybody has a possibility and everybody has the potential to become something different tomorrow than what they were yesterday. And so that I think our job is not to become judges, but to provide pathways of redemption that gets all of us out of the moral nihilism of white supremacy and all of the isms that strangle and retard the growth of our humanity.
I just got goosebumps when you lifted this image of speaking in tongues, because that really is about bringing everything that we are and speaking truth, but hearing each other, making space for each other to be heard. And I literally just got goosebumps, because that's an absolutely amazing, deeply spiritual reality.
Yes, I mean, because what white supremacists tell us in the culture of whiteness, that we can only speak with one tongue, and that tongue is the color of our skins. And so that's the only identity that gives us the legitimacy of existence. But what we have to understand is that even within Black America, we're not a monolith. That although all Black people carry the stigma of Blackness in a white supremacist society because of my history as being a descendant of a community of enslaved people who formed a counterculture, a resistance and accommodation that incorporated modalities that grew up out of the fields and plantations, and that turned site plantation fields that were intended to be sites of terror, turned them into zones of hope and redemption.
We're going to turn to my colleague and friend, Reverend Dr. Emma Jordan Simpson, who's a new executive director of Fellowship of Reconciliation, but with a deep, rich history as a senior pastor at Concord Baptist Church in Brooklyn, not senior, junior.
Executive pastor.
You see, I always get those religious
there
titles
is a senior.
Wrong. And of course, as a former executive director of the New York State branch of Children's Defense Fund, at this particular moment, really bring it up to today, as a faith-based person, as an organizer, as a spiritual person, what do you see as our work in this time of crisis?
Mm-hmm. Well, first I want to say that thanks and gratitude to everyone. I want to say that our work is to wake up, and to strengthen what remains. And I'm going to refer back to that, because that is something that Dr. King used. It's a phrase that he used when he was encouraging the staff of SCLC. First, I want to say something about spirituality, because this work is not, it is not just pedestrian. And it is not the kind of work that we can do on our own, and only using what we can see in front of our eyes. There are two elements of what I saw in Dr. King's spirituality that really resonated with me, still resonate with me, feed me, and I try to model that. I guess I need to say also that when I say spirituality for Martin Luther King, I'm talking about the understanding of the basic and fundamental belief that we are all created by God, by the divine, by however we want to name God. We are all created by God. We are God's creation. We are created in the image of God. There are no two or three or four classes of God's creation. And that I think for Martin Luther King, living with others who were also created in the image of God, breathing the breath that God loaned to them, and pursuing a life that honored that belief for him and for others, that effort was one about trying to live in right relationship, right? Trying to be in right relation, and to see the work of his faith and the work of justice to be more than just personal discipleship. This was not an individualistic sort of faith. And so I don't think that spirituality is radical if it's not rooted in, if it's only concerned with the self. That's not radical spirituality. In fact, I don't know what that is. and there's another side of this that I think is, we need to talk about, that it's a bit dangerous, because oppressed peoples have always been admonished to be selfless. And so this is not a self-negating, selfless spirituality. We are not less than other people. And Dr. King certainly did not see us or see himself as less than other people. It was a spirituality rooted in an understanding, however, that this was not just about ourselves, that this movement was not just about the freedom of Black people, that the point of the movement was also to free everyone. It may have begun in the passions of what it meant to be Black in this country at that time, but the effort was to make us all free. And there's a quote from Strength to Love that, you know, I really appreciate. He says, "One day we shall win freedom, but not for ourselves, not just for ourselves. We shall so appeal to your heart and conscience that we shall win you in the process. And our victory will be a double victory." That's some graduate level spirituality. That is that, and it's so difficult to hear a lot of the conversation we have today, what passes for spirituality, because it is not this graduate level understanding that if we are going to be free, we are all going to be free. If we are all going to be seen as as created by God, we are all created by God, and we are all due the rights associated with that. So this work, the movement was never just about the freedom of Black people. This was also, like, it was a little difficult for me growing up in Newark to relate to some of what I heard people talking about Martin Luther King. My earliest memories were of the 1967 uprising in Newark, the incredible violence and the guns of the National Guard. Those images are etched in my mind. And soon after Dr. King's death, I think that people began to lionize him and to take him out of context, to talk about that dream and to not talk about the nightmare that he saw, and to not talk about this conviction about poverty in this country. And so it was difficult for me as a young person growing up in Newark, New Jersey, 1960s, 1970s, to relate to that. And I did not really pursue an understanding of Dr. King until I got to college, until I got to Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, and I heard the stories of John Lewis, and I heard the stories of Diane Nash, and how they were inspired not just by him, but by that work. So, I'm really grateful for that. I want to say that for Martin Luther King, I also think that this is because of faith, not as as an aside, but that the quest for freedom and for human dignity and civil rights, the quest for us all to be free, there is no way to separate that quest from what it meant to understand himself, for us to understand ourselves as children of God. So there's a way to be free. The ends does not justify the means. There is a way for us to pursue this freedom. And I think about, when I think about like contemporary images, I'm thinking about one of the images that moves me so much from contemporary Black Lives Matter. And there is the image of the heavily militarized police response to peaceful protest, and there is a woman just standing in front, of these guns, and she's just standing there. And there is something incredibly powerful about that image, but also, something that, makes me afraid, because people don't respect the power of spirituality. The second thing about this radical, what I see is Dr. King's radical spirituality that I don't hear much talked about, is that there was a point when he pleaded with his staff. This, I think this was 1967. He pleaded with the staff not to shrink from lost causes and not to shrink from being associated with people who were considered to be the outcasts. This work isn't easy. This work is not easy. And I think the question, the most important question for me when I think about it is, you know, I'm asking, you know, what's your lost cause and who are your crew? You know, who, what are you trying, what are you pursuing right now with respect to justice? And who are you pursuing it with? And who is the voice of that? And I think about the contemporary Poor People's Campaign. I want to hear poor people's voices. You know, it is not a lost cause. I want to hear poor people's voices. But he said something to them. He said, in this effort to encourage them, he said, I would hope that we in SCLC are the custodians of hope. And I'm not talking about some kind of superficial optimism, which is a little more than magic. He said, I'm talking about the kind of hope that has an in spite of quality. Mm-hmm. That this is the kind of hope that doesn't come from taking a survey and seeing that this is absolutely something that we can do. This is the kind of hope that inspires people to pursue justice and to do that even if it looks like they absolutely, you know, are not going to win. It's about getting out there.
May I just say something,
yes,
about the hope,
Emma?
I think that we have to go back and visit that sermon that you just referenced that people have misunderstood.
Yes.
I Have a Dream.
Mm-hmm.
I Have a Dream was a radical statement. It was a statement based on Isaiah's vision of a new world coming and the kingdom of God coming on earth. It was a radical vision that said that I imagine the work that we are doing will create the transactional results that will create a situation where all people could sit down, all children could sit around a common table. I have a dream that my grandchild will not be an invisible element in American society. The dream was not separated from the word.
Mm-hmm.
It was people who did not understand the transcendental impulse that every movement that has survived and that has been a powerful movement, including Gandhi's movement, started out expressing a transcendental impulse,
mm-hmm,
that resided in the hearts of people, no matter who they were, no matter their differences.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see that even in the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That is not a transactional statement. That's a transcendental statement. So I think that we have to understand that King's spiritual call was for us to make a connection between who we are in the inside and how we live on the outside. He felt that we lived in a capitalist materialist society that dismembered us, that made us believe that we could say one thing and live another way, that we could have a contaminated inside and create a just society. And so he was calling on us to really rethink how we saw the world and how we saw injustice. When he raised the question, where do we go from here, from chaos to community, that was a radical statement that was saying to us, look, I want to let you know that contrary to what you've been told, injustice is lawlessness. Injustice breeds chaos. Injustice causes people who say that they represent the law to break the law. Injustice is disharmony. And so he was asking, are we going to continue to maintain the disharmony of segregation, the disharmony of de facto segregation? Are we going to move to that beloved community, to that community where all life has a value and currency? And I think that we must remember, as we celebrate and think about his legacy that Dr. Martin Luther King and the ordinary black people of which he sat himself beside was breaking down walls that began with the doctrine of discovery, walls that forced Native indigenous people to be on reservations, walls and barrios, walls that turned black and brown communities into ghettos, walls that as growing up in the segregated South, I was contained by walls. America has never gotten over its white supremacist fascination with walls, because walls are necessary in order to maintain, to leave some people out in order to maintain white supremacy. So I think that we have to look at what Martin Luther King was saying in light of where we are today. Why is it that some 60 or 50 years later, white America is still preoccupied with the business of building walls? And why are walls necessary in a growing society that is becoming majority people of color, black and brown? Why are walls urgent today? And why is democracy under attack? A democracy threatens white nationalism when white people are no longer the majority. Mm-hmm. So we've got to really begin to look at what is the hunger that drives, the spiritual hunger that drives the West that cannot be filled? What is the hunger that cannot be filled with power, has not been able to be filled with materialism? It's not a material hunger. Mm-hmm. It's a spiritual hunger that goes to the very soul of what it means to create a spirituality and an ideology of otherness and idolatry. What does it mean when you require people to bow down and worship at the altar of whiteness?
I think that you hit this right on the head. And when I think about this speech, which it makes me so angry what this country has done with this speech, because what we've done is to turn it into a soundbite. Even, you know, what does it mean? It's hard to understand that if you don't go back to the very beginning of it. Then and only then can you understand what that dream is, because he wasn't talking about something that we already had. And it was not this superficial, it was not the superficial hope. That's not what he was talking about.
No, I think he was talking about pragmatic hope, pragmatic optimism. I think you make a very good point.
Yeah.
He was not talking about an abstract. Mm-hmm. But I do think it was that pragmatic hope that King continued, that King expressed.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.